Welcome to the BMJ podcast. I'm Cameron Abassi, Editor-in-Chief of the BMJ. We have a jam-packed episode. First, we have Amy Edmondson, whose work on psychological safety has underpinned so much quality improvement.
You know, so that psychological safety starts to mean to people that I get all my needs met at all times and I feel comfortable and I feel fully, you know, like belonging and so on, which is good. I'm all for belonging, but we have to be sort of realistic about the complexity of human interactions.
This week, the BMJ has published two investigations looking at the alcohol industry and the tobacco industry and their funding of public health and education. Rebecca Coombs, who's overseen those investigations and she's the head of our journalism at the BMJ, joins us to explain what we've found.
Because we know that, you know, an industry needs to act in a way that best serves the commercial interests of an industry. So they're not going to fund something that that threatens their bottom line.
And finally, our NHS commissioners have some more recommendations, this time on workforce issues. Mary Dixon Woods and Matt Morgan tell the NHS how to fix its staffing and workforce crisis.
We've mentioned car parking a lot. That's just a good example. It's not that we are obsessed with car parking and, you know, sustainable transport is just as important. But things like rostering, you know, the things that affect my life on an everyday basis more than anything is probably my clinical rota.
Amy Edmondson, Professor of Leadership and Management at the Harvard Business School, was the keynote speaker at this year's International Forum on Quality and Safety in Healthcare, which is jointly organised by the BMJ and the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. Here's a clip of Amy Edmondson talking to Helen Serrano from the BMJ as part of our new podcast, which is going to be called Future Health.
Healthcare is by its nature a complex, error-prone system. Right? It's the production and the provision of care is inherently collaborative, involves collaborations between different caregivers, different roles with the patient, and every episode is in some way unique. Right? There's something about it that's customized or different or has never happened before in this exact same way, which puts a premium on a willingness to speak up to ensure that the best possible care is provided. If people see something that might be wrong, but they're not quite sure, so they hold back, that can literally be, in some cases, a matter of life and death.
We're talking a lot now about the importance of kindness in the workplace. And I just wondered what you felt the link was between that new enthusiasm for kindness and the link between that concept of psychological safety.
Well, I love the concept of kindness and I love the new emphasis on it. And it's and the reason is that to me, kindness stands in contrast to niceness. And I think many people, myself included, are sort of brought up to be nice, which can then lead us to hold back on saying things that somewhere in our brains, it feels like, well, that wouldn't be nice. So I'm not going to say it. Whereas kindness, in contrast, is about being kind enough to be willing to speak the truth, you know, to be willing to share your thoughts, in a timely way, in a respectful way. But not to choose holding back, which is always easy. So I mean, I think all of us want to work in an environment of respect and mutual trust, where we have a fundamental decency. It sometimes seems like table stakes, but it isn't. And so I think this new emphasis on what does it take to be kind, so long as that interpretation is not the same as nice, is very strong. It's very important.
And both of these concepts interplay a lot with this concept of hierarchy, which we know about
Yes.
in medicine. How do hierarchies affect how care is given?
Well, so, hierarchy is one of those very fundamental sort of principles of social organization that has been with us, been with the species since the beginning, and we're very sensitive to it. I mean, people are very quick to sort of size up a hierarchy in a new situation, and we'll nearly automatically, without thinking too much about it, monitor their response. They'll be more free and open in a group of peers than in a hierarchical group. Now that's, you know, that's neither good nor bad. That's an observed phenomenon, but it becomes bad when critical information or concerns or questions are not shared because of that natural tendency to hold back. So I like to say hierarchy creates a risk factor, you know, for psychological safety, for speaking up, for mutual learning. But it's, hierarchy's not bad, it just gives rise to risk. So the goal is, how do we mitigate that risk? How do we overcome the potential perils of hierarchy so that we get the strengths and power of hierarchy in the sense that, you know, if people have certain expertise, we want it to be well used. If people have a certain responsibility to kind of manage and monitor the team or the process, we want them to be able to do that well, while remaining aware that hierarchy can stifle input in ways that will come back to haunt the very person who's maybe higher up in the hierarchy.
Thanks. You gave a great example in your book about advice you give to leaders when they ask you what factor is important about in creating a psychological safe environment. And you said you ask them one question, which is, do people bring you something along the lines of, do people bring you bad news?
Right.
Can you just tell that?
Right. Well, I think the question is something along the lines of, what is the ratio of green to red? You know, how much bad news are you hearing? How frequently are you hearing requests for help? Are you hearing updates that are not precisely what we had hoped for? You know, and versus good news or all's well, you know, and my argument back to them is, if you're not hearing the red, if it's all green, you will have had a better week. And it may not be a good sign. Right? It may be a sign, because look at where you work. You know, it's a complex, error-prone, novel, uncertain zone. And so it's starting to be very aware of the sounds you're not hearing, the signals that may not be making it to you, that could let you know that you've got more work to do to truly create safety for speaking up.
We're trying to think about sort of what's next. And I've been thinking about this sort of psychological safety organizational awareness movement. I feel like more people in society generally are becoming more psychologically literate. Organizations are too. What do you think the evolution of this movement is, and what's next?
Well, I think that the what's next or the evolution is greater clarity, because I think you're absolutely right. There's been more awareness, but that awareness has happened. It's at risk of expanding to everything, you know, so that psychological safety starts to mean to people that I get all my needs met at all times, and I feel comfortable, and I feel fully, you know, like belonging and so on, which is good. I'm all for belonging, but we have to be sort of realistic about the complexity of human interactions, that they will always be somewhat fraught. They will always be, you know, I'll always have a little bit of anxiety. Can I say this here? But I want, so my aspiration for this going forward is that we get greater clarity about what psychological safety is and what it isn't. And with that clarity, we are more able to ensure that relevant ideas, questions, concerns, mistakes are always heard, while also keeping in mind kind of realistic expectations about what work is and why it matters and who we're serving. And fundamentally, we're serving, in your case, patients, not ourselves. I mean, we are served by the meaning and importance of the work, you know, of the work we do. We are served by knowing that we mattered today. And I think that's an incredibly powerful experience to have, to know that you matter, that you're helping people, that you're making a difference, rather than being served by sort of feeling comfortable or all my needs are met at all times.
That was Amy Edmondson talking to Helen Surana on our Future Health podcast. If you're interested in how to make medicine work better, subscribe to that podcast. It's available anywhere you're listening to this one. You can also watch Amy Edmondson's full keynote on our International Forum site. Links are in the podcast notes. Now, there are two investigations going up this week, and Rebecca Coombs, Head of Journalism at the BMJ, joins me to talk about them. Welcome, Bex.
Hello.
Tell us about these investigations.
Yeah, and I suppose both of them link to our BMJ interest in sort of exposing harmful effects of corporate vested interests on the health of communities. And the first one's about tobacco. And I think early this month, we got a tip-off that Philip Morris International was sponsoring education modules on Medscape. I mean, Medscape being global continuing medical education provider, very popular in the US. And this was causing an outcry from doctors and academics because it was portraying Philip Morris products like smokeless tobacco products as relatively harmless. And of course, it aligns with Philip Morris commercial interests. These are products that they want to sell. And some of the courses that were on Medscape were things like nicotine misconceptions, what does the evidence say, and the health impact of tobacco products, what do we know in 2024? So it's all intended to show PMI as sort of part of the solution, not the problem.
So that's incredible, because I mean, some people say you shouldn't take any industry funding for medical education, but to take it from the tobacco industry.
Yes.
That's quite an extreme step.
Yeah. And Medscape initially came out to defend themselves and said, we're actually doing nothing wrong. PMI have had no influence on these modules. The accreditation companies say this is fine and all part of their own standards. But I mean, the problem, there was a problem of taking the money in the first place, but there was also, it was clear that it had influenced the content. Hmm. Obviously, our experts tell us that the health goal should be to break nicotine addiction and to stop use of all tobacco products. But there were some examples in some of the courses, such as somebody who was trying to stop smoking, but one of the options offered was just to cut down or to move to a pipe, which is not what you'd expect.
No. I mean, and from people who use Medscape, has there been a reaction to this?
Yeah, a huge reaction. And so much so that we now believe that Medscape have U-turned, according to internal emails that we've seen, and have broken with Philip Morris International and will no longer be working with any tobacco company.
And what was the second investigation?
The second investigation was, we were looking at the influence of big alcohol on education, public health education around safe drinking, and educating particularly children as young as 9 on the harms of alcohol. Now, in Ireland, public health campaigners have been very successful in banning the alcohol industry from schools. But we found plenty of examples of where they're still active in British schools and also universities. So Diageo, for example, backs a filter group that goes in to schools called Smashed. We all know, as one of our experts told us, about the Freshers Week of Oblivion. And DrinkAware, who are sort of a body that is funded by the alcohol industry as well as hospitality groups, are providing plastic shot glasses for students, as well as a cardboard wheel to show them, to educate them about how many units are in different drinks.
Yeah, so these are both examples of something we call the commercial determinants of health. But the alcohol one is a little different, in the industry is involved in raising awareness about the harms of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that in itself
seems problematic.
So what's
wrong with that,
right? Well, it doesn't seem quite right to me.
I think the problem is, and we've talked to people at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, as well as others, who say the emphasis is all wrong. The emphasis is on the individual teaching themselves how to be safe, whereas actually we need to see much more action further upstream with restriction of alcohol availability and also alcohol promotion. Actually, here's just a little clip of us talking to Mae Van Schalkwyk, who's a researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
I think what is concerning in the UK is the extent to which, you know, alcohol industry funded groups have very much dominated that public awareness, public warning and public information space. The issue of conflicts of interest is extremely important here, because we know that, you know, an industry needs to act in a way that best serves the commercial interests of an industry, so they're not going to fund something that that threatens their bottom line. So they're going to fund materials that are ultimately favourable to them, about promoting the types of narratives that place the burden on individuals and deflect from them as a driver of harm. What is effective is curriculum that is delivered consistently throughout the year and over the years of education, and that curriculum really teaches about, you know, refusal skills. But what we see with this is again kind of single risk factor focused curriculum, very much about peer pressure, all about responsible drinking, and even in some of the materials, you know, teaching children how about units and how to pour a standard drink, and that's very much against you know, what we know is to be most effective.
Yeah, so there are two issues again here. One is that I think there's a wealth of evidence that tells us that leaving these kinds of policy decisions, these kinds of initiatives and interventions to individuals, they tend not to work, and you need to have something at a higher level, a policy change, a change in the law, some regulation. And that isn't what's happening here, and that's what's needed.
Yeah, and there's a gap into which industry-backed groups are stepping and doing it very effectively and in a way that seems fairly innocuous. And as we know, there's plenty of material in this week's BMJ about the success of minimum unit pricing and how the alcohol industry have been very successful in keeping that off the statute books in England. And we still see many examples of industry's influence on policymakers today.
Yeah, and the second point is that there are also different examples from many different industry settings that industry self-regulation isn't really effective.
No, we all remember the responsibility groups that were set up when Andrew Lansley was Health Secretary. I mean, I'm not quite sure what happened to those, but they were always cited as because they were there, we didn't need stronger regulation by the state.
Yeah, so why isn't something it seems pretty clear that both those points aren't that hard to understand, but yet we don't seem to change our approach.
We don't seem to. Well, I think because one could argue that we have a government who is fairly soft on industry. And it's good to see examples elsewhere, like in Ireland, where public health campaigners have been successful. I think we also say maybe public health campaigners need to shout a bit louder about this.
Okay.
Well, we could certainly scope for change.
Yeah, we could help them with that. And just to go back to what should happen about raising awareness in terms of the harms related to alcohol, what do you think should happen now?
I think that we should introduce a minimum unit pricing,
which is working in Scotland.
It's working really well in Scotland and also parts of Australia. It's also been introduced in Wales now, and as the evidence mounts, one can only wonder why other governments don't adopt it. It can't be for reasons of empirical evidence. It must be for other reasons, namely cozy relationship with alcohol industry.
Yeah, but if there are these awareness campaigns and awareness organisations and initiatives, they should not be funded by industry. Industry should not be involved in them.
Absolutely not.
No.
As I said, we've got examples elsewhere where others have thrown off the shackles of industry funding, all to the good. And I think where it exists, it's only going to create concerns about bias and influence.
Bex, thank you very much. Those investigations are live on bmj.com. Links, again, are in the podcast notes. Our NHS Commission continues, and we've just published a paper on workforce issues. Evelyn, our editorial scholar, who's taking a year out of medical school to work at the BMJ, has her whole work life ahead of her. And so we thought Eva was the right person to talk to our commissioners about workforce and what it will mean to her and her generation of doctors. So Eva, what do the next generation of doctors think about going into the workforce with things as they are?
Well, I can't speak for the entire next generation of doctors, but between conversations I've had with, you know, medics that I have went to uni with, conversations I've had on the podcast, and a little bit of evidence, I guess, we can't see anything good, really. There's lots of big feelings, not many of them positive. There's kind of an overarching umbrella of distress and panic, I would say. Morale is pretty low in medical schools at the moment.
Yeah, that's really sad. That's really sad, because presumably you went into it with some high ideals, some noble ambitions.
I mean, didn't we all? I think I think we all go into medicine hoping to change things for the better, hoping to do the best by people, and also, you know, just wanting like a career that works for us and that enables us to kind of reach the goals that we want to, for ourselves and for our patients. And I think what's been really jarring is that I didn't start medical school that long ago. I only started in 2019. And even since then, the face of medicine has changed, you know, beyond recognition. There has been a huge change to how foundation program recruitment has happened since, like, every year I've been at medical school, it's changed. And, you know, you're seeing that reflected with, you know, we've now been striking for most of my time at the BMJ and beyond. Lots of change in the air, I think.
Yeah, you've been discussing these issues in Sharp Scratch, which is a really excellent podcast, primarily targeted at students and early career doctors. And what kind of themes emerge in those conversations that you have, Eva?
Yeah, earlier this month on Sharp Scratch, we actually discussed hope, which is quite topical, I suppose, contrasting how we feel about our hopes for patients and medicine more broadly versus kind of the hopelessness that we see so much and feel so much about our own careers. Also recently on Sharp Scratch, we've talked about loneliness. We've talked a little bit about, you know, like workplace culture and how valued we feel in the workplace with the remarkable Professor Michael West, also of Lancaster University. There's been lots of really valuable kind of discussions, not unlike those that I had with the commissioners.
Okay, well, let's hear your conversation with Mary Dixon Woods and Matt Morgan.
Morning, Eva. Very nice to see you. My name is Mary Dixon Woods, and I'm the director of the Healthcare Improvement Studies Institute at the University of Cambridge.
Hello, everyone. Matt Morgan. There's three bits to my life. I'm a full-time NHS intensive care consultant based in Cardiff. I'm also involved in some public engagement work, having written two books. And the third bit of my life is I'm actually employed by the BMJ and also write a regular column.
One of the main themes that came out of your paper, one of the, I guess, most central parts of it was working conditions within the NHS. You talk about, and this is a quote, a sense that NHS systems do not always seem to value people as people, but instead as resources to sweat. There are also some rather harrowing statistics. 41.7% of staff report feeling unwell as a result of workplace stress in the last 12 months. Less than two-thirds feel safe to speak up about the things that concern them. So I guess, could you tell us a little bit about what you propose in the paper to kind of help mitigate some of those things?
Clearly, there are an awful lot of challenges in terms of workplace conditions for people who work in the NHS, and there are problems not just for staff, but also for patients. I mean, it's a truism that happy staff is important for happy patients who are well cared for. Some of the issues are really quite mundane and unglamorous. They're to do with basic conditions of having fridges, lockers, somewhere to put your bike safely. All that sort of stuff is really important to people's day-to-day experience of work. And we think that should be a real priority for NHS organisations. A second thing that we call out quite significantly in the paper is the issue of essentially workplace conduct and behaviour. NHS staff are exposed to unacceptable levels of bullying and sometimes, unfortunately, discriminatory and racist behaviours. It's not acceptable, and there needs to be really strong emphasis on dealing with that at policy level all the way through to individual trusts. And we think the NHS needs to be supported with a really strong framework, essentially an HR-focused framework, a people framework to help them, to help support them in doing this.
I guess the first thing to say is this is hard. You know, it's difficult. The NHS is a beast of an organisation, and it's not one organisation. So, you know, coming up with a set of or a package of solutions is hard because it's hard. I love the fact that Mary started with those unglamorous things. You know, what brings me joy in going to work, and I'm sorry to be basic about this, is parking my car, seeing my friends and colleagues, having somewhere to eat, having somewhere to rest. You know, they're not complex things. But we've also got to recognise there is huge fiscal pressure in for trusts as well as the whole organisation. So if they have to decide between, you know, another outpatient clinic or a locker room for staff, in the past, perhaps they've thought, well, it's the outpatient clinic. But what we're trying to say is that beds don't care for patients, people care for patients.
It seems quite far away with how things are at the minute. I was just wondering if you had any kind of suggestions or ideas of how we get from where we are now to, like, I guess, what you propose.
We've achieved an awful lot in the NHS by being very focused about things. And when we see the best results, it's when there is a clear priority given to something, there's a clear framework, trust know what to do, and the challenge then is implementing it well. What we don't have at the moment, I believe, is enough focus on these kinds of things so that the whole people issue, the workforce issue, doesn't get the priority, as Matt says. So it's not being considered alongside the outpatients clinic. Clearly, the outpatients clinic is a priority. I think what we're saying is when you're considering priorities, make sure you're considering staff experience as well. And having an overarching framework for this kind of thing, it's unglamorous. It doesn't feel like a kind of policy thing in the same way as numbers of physiotherapists or buildings does. But our view is that this is just as important. The staff experience is really, really critical.
Matt, have you anything to add on that question?
Yeah, I guess the good news about basic things is that sometimes they are basic to fix too, and sometimes they're even cost neutral. You know, I spent some time working in Australia over the last few years, and one of the things they do there, which is included in the paper, is they actually have two weekly pay cycles, so you get paid every 2 weeks rather than four. Now, that seems like a very small, you know, simple thing, and why is that good? Well, we know actually a lot of the staff employed by the NHS are on, you know, very low wages, actually, if you look at Agenda for Change, and budgeting can be complex. We also know that pay errors are very common. And so changing that cycle from 4 to 2 weeks actually may address some of those issues to help with budgeting, to help with errors. And, you know, that's a pretty cost neutral thing to do. So, you know, we're not unaware of the fiscal demands on the health service. And I guess the other thing is transparency, you know, aggressive transparency. We've seen this for things like MRSA rates or pressure sores. You know, you walk into a ward, you see on the wall when was the last pressure sore identified. That's aggressive transparency. Well, perhaps we could do the same for working condition. So I think, you know, recording, displaying and having transparency about these things can help bring it up the agenda and may help staff vote with their feet too. You know, maybe they'll want to go to work in those tricky rural hospitals, which historically find it hard to recruit, if they address these really key workforce challenges.
Absolutely. I think a lot of the things that you touched on just now, both of you, from the I guess, bad behaviour, the lack of confidence in the freedom to speak up system, to things like lack of food and car parking spaces, kind of point to this wider problem that of, I guess, a lack of trust and a lack of confidence that I guess doctors and I suppose other staff too have in systems around them. It's something I've seen myself even at my very, very early stage in career as I've watched my friends try to navigate the new UK FPO application process. I suppose I just wanted to know if you guys think that this kind of lack of trust, lack of confidence from staff regarding the organisations and the systems they work in is the crux of a lot of this, a lot of the issues that your paper points to.
There is a whole social science literature on how you build trust, and it is to do with essentially finding common purpose, shared understanding, building systems so people feel that they can respect that when processes operate, they will operate in the interests of the entity as a whole. So I agree that the job now is to rescue trust and to do evidence-based things we need to do in order to restore that. We're engaged with people who work in the NHS on a daily basis. I'm constantly massively impressed by the quality of people who work in the NHS, the ingenuity they bring to their job, the commitment, the values that drive them. This is a world-class institution by any measure, and we need to make sure it sustains.
We are taught a lot at medical school about how we don't like deviation from the norm, we don't like variation in clinical practice. I just wanted to know a little bit more about why some places get that so right and others get it so wrong.
So variation is a fact of life. In fact, not just in healthcare, but if you look at any industry, you will find that there is variations, even in organisations that are part of the same chain, you get variations. So it's a fact of life, really. And the question is, how do we learn from positive deviants, as we call them, the people on the far end of the spectrum who seem to be doing it really well? We also know that there are lots of things you can do to kind of raise the floor as opposed to raising the ceiling. And some of that is clarity about standards. Matt said it earlier, if you have standards about how many people have been able to park their car or get to work in a reasonable time or put their bike in a safe place, that's a standard. You can set a standard for that, and then once you've set a standard, you can measure it. Those standards need to be co-designed with people, so you're taking account of all of the relevant things, like what's important to staff, what's important to patients, what's the environmental consequences of this, what's the cost. All that has to be in there, and you can do that if you use a kind of co-design process to design the standards. You've absolute clarity about it. And then there's lots of things that actually we think should be responsibility of individual organisations, but actually should be designed at scale. And then the job for individual organisations is to implement them. And Matt will have a million examples of this from his clinical practice. But it's one of the things where we expect individual trusts or organisations to come up with new processes for handling things or sorting something out. And actually, it would be much better if there was a collaboration, a collective level way of doing this. And then, and this is where I think medical students and early career doctors would have a great opportunity to do this, because they're in there doing it every day. So bringing them together on large scale and helping to co-design those processes, I think, could make a huge difference. And it's not all about individual organisations.
Yes, but spot on. And I guess One thing I would say is sometimes it's constraints which force individual organisations to do things better. You know, I mentioned rural working hospitals. I work in Wales, where there's, you know, a big problem with staff recruitment in some rural areas, and often it's those hospitals actually that have innovated the most in order to attract staff and retain staff. I love what Mary said about it being the job of individual organisations to deploy the standards rather than create them. And, you know, what an amazing opportunity for this massive organisation to apply evidence-based, you know, great working practices. We've mentioned car parking a lot. That's just a good example. It's not that we are obsessed with car parking and, you know, sustainable transport is just as important. But things like rostering, you know, the things that affect my life on an everyday basis more than anything is probably my clinical rota. You know, and simple things like forward rotational planning to go into night shifts where you get ever later shifts and then a night, working with circadian rhythms. This isn't rocket science. This has been known about from, you know, factory rostering practices for generations. But what an amazing opportunity there would be for the NHS to apply this ubiquitously and say to individual organisations, right, this is what we're doing. This is the evidence. Now, please apply that to your own special circumstance.
That paper from the NHS Commission and all of our recommendations are now available on bmj.com. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week hearing how Simon Stevens, who led the NHS for 7 years, thinks healthcare could become more sustainable. Subscribe to the podcast on all major podcast apps to hear that interview. I'm Cameron Abassi. Thanks for listening.